introduction, and I have to say from the very beginning that I'm going to keep it very simple. We'll cover some of the old material, so if any of you feel bored at any point and decide to walk out, I promise not to take that personally. What I'm going to talk about is essentially some pieces of a body of work that I did with Mike and Chayton, and I'm sure based on even earlier work that was done with Mike, Chayton, Kevin, and Walt. It will be based on the models of loop gases that we're discussing, let me actually introduce these models so we all know what I'm talking about. Basically, the models. So I'm going to talk about some local Hamiltonians, which I'm not going to write explicitly, although I almost will. The reason I'm not going to write them explicitly is because it's not particularly educating, they look ugly, but it's much easier to describe what they do as opposed to actually write the explicit expression. So,
these are artificial Hamiltonians, or is that Hamiltonian that arise in some real context?
What do you consider real?
It's studying some physical problem, quantum Hall effect, you know,
on a real
piece of paper. No, they're artificial from that point of view. Although, who knows, they might be able to hook some of these Hamiltonians with optical light, as per the solar flow does.
Are Hamiltonians in quantum dots real or artificial?
No, he answered the question.
Oh, by the way, are quantum Hall Hamiltonians real or?
Yeah, it's very real.
The five body ones.
The wave functions may not be real.
Alright. Yeah, so I'm going to talk about it. Speaking of wave functions, it's much easier here than talking about Hamiltonians. Very similar, by the way, to what happens in quantum Hall systems. Basically what I want to do is I want to talk about local Hamiltonians whose ground states can be described as collections of loops. And what these loops are made of, they're made of some local degrees of freedom. For example, we can talk about some spin Hamiltonians, so these loops are made of some loops on some spins on the lattice. And in order to be specific, let me actually give you an example of that. So let me consider some lattice, and for simplicity, it's going to be a honeycomb lattice, which I wrote. I'm drawing here. And the Hamiltonian will consist of several pieces. The biggest piece of the Hamiltonian is going to be simply something like this. It's going to be sum over all sites or all vertices of this lattice, and then it's going to be 1 plus the product over all trivalent vertices of this lattice of simply sigma iz, where sigma iz is just the component of a spin half, is the component of spin half, and each site has one spin half living at that side. So this is just the first term of the Hamiltonian, but let's just see what this term does. What this term does, it measures the three components of spins. Did I say spins live on the sites? The spins live on the links of this lattice, so in the middle of each link. So what this term does, it looks at whether the spins point up or down, and let's see which configurations are favored by this Hamiltonian. The configurations that are favored, that these are the configurations that minimize this, are the configurations where either all three spins look down, or one spin looks down and two spins look up. Something like this. And this gives us an idea of how to represent the ground states, which are many of this Hamiltonian in terms of loops. That is, I'm going to draw a line every time the spin on a corresponding bond points up. So this tells me that the only configurations that minimize this are whether two spins are up or none of the spins are up. And if you do it for the entire lattice, you quickly realize that you end up with some collection of loops on this lattice. And the loops are defined as I just explained. Now, this is, by the way, very reminiscent of a Plaquet term in the Alexei Pitaev story code, and this was actually the inspiration for that. Now, we also need to introduce, so far,
vertex term.
Yeah, sorry, the vertex term. We also need the analog of the Plaquet term there. We'll introduce some dynamics on the space of these ground states. And once again, just like in the toric code, you could flip any plaquette. Here we will do some flipping of some plaquettes, but not all of them. What do I mean by flipping? What I mean, and here I stop writing Hamiltonian, although it still can be written down in terms of spins, it just looks progressively ugly. So the kind of terms I'm going to add to this Hamiltonian are the terms that do, for example, the following. This would be an allowed term, the term that acts on this plaquette and moves this configuration into that configuration. You see that it didn't really change the topology of loops, it just moved the loop a little bit. So basically all terms that do something like this, that if you look at a plaquette of a honeycomb lattice and you have a number of spins that points up, what you can do is you can flip this plaquette, that is replace, erase these lines, that is move these spins into the down position and raise these spins. Every time you do this, you don't really change the topology of loops. You conserve the number, you don't really do anything particularly interesting. So this is what the referred in a long time as the isotopy move. So it just changes the slightly geometry of the loops. All right, so,
Chris,
yeah.
Do you want this to be connected or you can also do it not connected? Just if you
have Well, I mean, this is the biggest term in my Hamiltonian, so I'm only interested in what happens in the ground state subspace, if you wish.
No, I'm asking the question, if you want to change it, suppose you have a hexagon.
Yeah.
If you have, the wide arcs you have, your joists connected, but suppose
right. I'm going to talk about this. So this is one kind of allowed term, the term that moves a connected piece, sort of flips the plaquette and moves it to its complement, if you wish. All right? So the other kind of term that we're going to allow is, so this is isotopy. The other kind of term that we're going to allow is the term that makes an empty plaquette, that is the plaquette, the spins around which all point down, to flicker into the plaquette where all spins point up. Now this corresponds to a creation of a small loop or annihilation, depending on which way you go. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the relative weights of these configurations in a second. But as Zhenkang asked a minute ago, something we are not going to allow is a move that would determine a Hamiltonian that would do something like this. This being moved into its complement is not allowed. And you might even guess the reason why it's not going to be allowed, because if I think of some loops attached to these particular edges, when I do this, you realize that I actually do something rather violent to the loops. That is, in this case, I had two loops, and suddenly I went and made a single loop out of them. By the way, I have to make reference to the other types of models that are probably familiar to some of you, which sort of have
very similar dynamics and very similar ground states, and those are the quantum dipole models. And basically, these are the type of moves that exist there. You know, well, there is only one dynamic move, that is the flip of a plaquette. Can be thought of as cutting and reconnecting loops. All right. So
how are you going not to allow this last term?
So it's just the way, you know, it's writing down the terms of the Hamiltonian, right? So I can write the term for this if you wish. So this would correspond to S. So let me number the links. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. For example, the term that does this dynamics is the term of this type. It's, what is this? It's S.
You're using sigma here.
I'm sorry?
I think you're using sigma.
Yeah, sigma, I'm sorry. It is sigma 1 minus sigma 2 plus sigma 3 plus sigma 4 plus sigma 5 plus and then sigma 6 minus, right? Then, of course, there will be a Hermitian conjugate to that term that will move you in the opposite direction. What I'm going to disallow are the terms of this type, sigma 1 minus, sigma 2 plus, sigma 3 minus, or something like this, etc. These are the kind of terms that would allow this dynamics.
Why do you allow creation of loops anyway, then, in the bottom? Why is that?
Well, because without creation of loops, I have a hugely degenerate ground state. That is, the number of loops is conserved. Period and end. Right? So, if I start with a state with a given fixed number of loops, I'm never going to get out of it. So, by allowing this kind of creation and annihilation of loops, I'm definitely reducing the dimensionality of my ground state. And basically, the goal is to reduce it down to a finite number, which will correspond to a topological model, topological state. But I'm not quite there yet. So what I must say is that
it seems like through a combination of isotopia and loop creation, you can go from the two and do that disallowed.
What I'm saying, sorry,
the move that's disallowed.
This one? Well, in some cases I would be able to. So, what you mean is that by a sequence of these moves, I can in some cases, you know, go between these two cases. That is absolutely correct. But let me tell you why I'm not going to allow this move explicitly. And the reason for this is follows. As far as the isotopy moves are concerned, what I want them to do is I want them to, I'm going to construct a projector out of them. And this projector is going to annihilate the state, which is an equal weight superposition of loops that are different by this simple isotopy move. Now, as far as this move is concerned, the one that creates and annihilates the loops, I'm not going to insist on the equal weight superposition of these two pictures. I'm going to reward this by assigning it an extra amplitude, which I'm going to call D. So that is, if I look at two pictures, which correspond to the two states, two quantum mechanical states, the state with an extra loop in it is going to have an amplitude which is D times the state without. Now, if this can only happen locally, that is, a small plaquette can flicker between having a loop and not having a loop, then I have a control over the amplitudes of that. On the other hand, here, as you can see, I have no way of telling whether I went, whether going this way, I decreased the number of loops by one, as drawn here, or whether I increased it, because it all depends on how the loops are connected outside, and this is something non-local. Here's an example. If the loops were connected like this, then, in fact, by performing this action, I increase their number by 1 rather than decreased. So I wouldn't know what effect this term in the Hamiltonian would do. So indeed, I should be able to change the number of loops by consequent application of the loop creation and annihilation and moving them around. But what I don't allow is I don't allow local cutting and reconnecting the loops where I have no idea what these loops look like outside. And that's the reason for disallowing this kind of loops. All right.
Question.
Yeah.
Can any loop by successive isotropy operations be reduced to one hexagonal bouquet?
So that really depends on the details of the Hamiltonian. And in this particular case, you can actually show that that's possible. So in principle, if you look at some surface of, some simple surface with a boundary with a sphere, that is not a torus or anything like this. So, if you don't have any essential loops, then any loop can be shrunk to a single plaquette and then annihilated. So from that point of view, this Hamiltonian is perfectly ergodic. Any picture with loops is connected to any other picture with loops by consequent by the subsequent application of these dynamics. Now, of course, the interesting issue is what happens when you put this Hamiltonian on a surface which is a sphere, which is a torus, or has higher genus. Then, of course, there is a degeneracy of the ground states, which scales with the size of the torus, with its perimeter, actually, because none of the essential loops that you might be able to place there can be undone by the application of this Hamiltonian, because it can only destroy or create very, very small loops. All right, so now, so far, this is not really a topological model. This is what we would call a quasi-topological model. So if you really want a topological model, you actually need to implement the moves like that, but you need to implement them in a very careful way. And let me mention what I mean by that. So basically, there are two types of terms that I just described. And let me, instead of looking at the honeycomb lattice, just do it in the continuum, because it's much easier to draw. So far, what I told you is that if you have some loop, you're allowed to bend it by some local term in the Hamiltonian, and that's the first term. Then if you have no loop locally, what you can do is you can create a small loop and reward yourself with the factor of D, or go the other way. And then finally, what you want to do is you want to implement some terms that allow you to cut and reconnect these loops. And these are the terms that, in the simplest case, look something like this. And we can talk about the factors that go in here. Now, it turns out that if you insist on having this kind of dynamics in your system, as you would if you implemented that term, the only allowed values of D here are plus or minus 1. And by the way, this value of D also goes in here. So this is a very restrictive kind of dynamics. In principle, depending on the value of D, you might be able to implement other kinds of projectors. For example, a projector that cuts and reconnects three strands. Now, this is the projector that looks something like this. Well, not something like this, but exactly like that. What this means is that if you have five terms in your superposition that are locally different by the rearrangements of three lines, then the amplitudes in your ground state superposition are given by this expression. So, well, once again, we can write a term like this in terms of these spins on the honeycomb lattice. It's going to be an 11-spin interaction and nothing particularly pretty, as you may guess. Now, every time I implement a projector like this with 3, 4, and so on strands, I actually do some violence here. And what I mean by that is that is that I actually have to enforce a certain value of D. Before that, D could be anything. If I implement a projector that fixes the value of D, and the value of D that I'm getting in this particular case is the square root of 2. And the next one, if I implemented the four-strand projector, the next value of D, so this is D for level 3 theory, and the, sorry, for level 2 theory, and then for the level 3, it would be the golden ratio.
So, sir, what exactly fixes D? You have the Hamiltonian, now you have projectors, and now where is D fixed at what stage?
Well, all right, so let me do it here. It's the simplest example, and in principle you can do it for any level, you can do it by iterations. So basically, if you want to allow this kind of term in your Hamiltonian, then this term should be completely insensitive to what happens outside, right? So let's analyze the possibilities. So what could happen outside could be something like this, right? And I mean, it can happen at any distance. Could be a large loop.
So is your point that you want this term to act inside of the ground state manifold of the state?
Yes.
Okay.
And I want this term commute with that term in the ground state manifold.
Okay.
Does that make sense? So you immediately see that here, I'm, you know, since now I can really shrink this loop by subsequent application of isotropy and then annihilate it, this forces this D to be equal to that D. And well, actually what you can do is you can then analyze another case where the connection went like this and you would find out that D is equal to 1 over D. And that automatically forces D to be either plus or minus 1. Does that answer the question? All right. So now what I want to talk about is the spectral properties of this Hamiltonian with and without projectors implemented. And so let me first of all tell you a few things that we know about these theories with projectors. Well, first of all, the simplest example of the theories with projectors would be Alexei's toric code and the quantum dimer models, such as the quantum dimer model on the triangular lattice, where you are allowed to have this move as I just drew it over there. And what we know is that at least at D equals 1 case, these models correspond to some gapful Hamiltonians where the excitations are deconfined, as was shown in the paper by, for example, for the quantum dimer models was shown by Sondi, Mersner, and Fendley, and it's kind of a trivial statement for Alexei's toric code. Now, so as I said, the excitations are deconfined, the model has a gap, and moreover, all local correlations of physical operators actually should range. Now, what's interesting is that if you try to implement the model without such projector, then the models are provably gapless, and that is what I'm going to tell you about. But before I do this, let me actually mention a few things. So, first of all, something I failed to mention so far. Why is implementing this projector important? Well, first of all, this is what reduces the degeneracy of a ground state on a torus, for example, because consider the D equals 1 state. If I had a torus, or even a cylinder for that matter, and I had any numbers of loops, with the Hamiltonian that does not allow cutting and reconnecting these loops, there is no way of undoing these loops. On the other hand, the moment I have such projector implemented, I can bring any two loops close to each other, cut, reconnect them, and then undo the loops. So you see that in this case, the number of loops around a cylinder or any generator of a torus is conserved mode 2. So I go from infinite degeneracy to degeneracy which is 2 times, 2 to the genus of of the surface in this case. The same happens with three strand projectors. Well, in this case, the degeneracy will be three to the genus of the surface. Secondly, and maybe if I have time, I'll do that, but something tells me I won't. Implementing these projectors is actually essential for getting a non-trivial statistics of excitations. And the excitations in this kind of model, well, the simplest kind of excitations are just the loose ends of loops. So if we violate this term, we break a loop, and then you have two endpoints, and these endpoints actually have a non-trivial statistics, which arises precisely as a result of having these projectors implemented. Now, perhaps if I have time, as I said, I'll show how to get that in the simplest case. But let me now shift gears and tell you a little bit about what will happen if we don't have these projectors. Well, the interesting observation is that the ground state on a sphere, for example, or a surface with a boundary of some sort, as long as the loops are not allowed to end on the boundary. Let's say, just consider a surface with a boundary, but the boundary conditions we are talking about are the ones that force all loops to live inside. The ground state with and without projectors, given the compatible value of t, is actually exactly the same. And the reason for that is that, this careful choice of d's made certain that these projectors commute with the rest of the Hamiltonian when acting on this ground state. Therefore, they have the same ground state. Now, as I said, the degeneracy of the ground state is different on the higher genus surface. By the way, what I'm going to tell you is not only true for the loop models that I described. It's also true for the for a slightly more interesting case of trivalent graphs, such as were discussed by Paul Fenley and Eduardo, and also by Mike Levin and Shogun Wen. And in fact, the trivalent graphs are not unrelated to the loop model that I'm discussing now, because in principle, if you look at any trivalent graph, that also represents some microscopic degrees of freedom, you can, in principle, kind of zoom in and represent sort of double every line and think of this as a collection of loops with the condition that the two lines run together. In fact, you would need to implement a certain kind of projector here, but I'm not going to go into these details. All I'm saying is that these models are not unrelated to the models that I'm going to talk about, and therefore actually the statement I'm about to make is true whether you talk about these models or the loop models that I described them. So now let me make a statement. The statement is that without projectors implemented, the ground state, the Hamiltonian. I can speak too late for that.
Just get whatever now. Put that on hammer scope for you.
This is good because all I told you about before was probably talked about here more than once. So what I'm going to tell you now probably hasn't been, or maybe has been, but definitely not more than once. So basically, what I'm about to show you now is that if I don't have projectors implemented in the loop theory or the trivalent graphs, for that matter, theories, then the Hamiltonian, whatever the local details of the Hamiltonians are, as long as they do the kind of things that I described, that is, allow my loops fluctuate and allow them to be created out of nothing or destroyed, as long as it's local,
and such Hamiltonian is gapless. So let me sketch the proof for you here. Well, actually, before I do this, I need to pull up one more result, and that is the result from the statistical mechanics which needs to be used here. And the result is as follows. First of all, let me ask myself, what is the ground state of this Hamiltonian? I already described to you what it looks like, but let me actually write it down. Let me start with some definition. So let me call a state alpha sort of any snapshot of local variables that that form these loops. So this is what we call a multi-loop, a single snapshot of that. Now the ground state of this Hamiltonian, which you should call psi naught, is going to be the sum over all possible pictures with loops, all possible arrangements of local variables that make those loops. Now, d to the number of loops, you know, this is the number of loops in a particular snapshot, times alpha. So this is a superposition. This is not an equal weight superposition, or at least, no, it's not one or something like that, right?
You know what? Why don't we just...
It's really pointless, I think.
Okay.
It's
ready for that.
So D is this parameter that I introduced here, and I already erased it. It's the amplitude for adding an extra loop, and this is just the number of loops. And that's the ground state. Now, the interesting quantity to look at is the norm squared of this ground state, which is just the sum over all pictures d to the 2. Now, what we assume here is that different configurations of local variables that correspond to different pictures actually are orthogonal to each other. Therefore, when you take a square norm, that's all you can get. Now, what we're going to do now is to compare this to a statistical mechanical partition function of some known models. And I'm not going to go into the details of that, I'm just going to draw the results, or at least the sketch the results for you. The models that have loops as their degrees of freedom, the statistical mechanical models, arise from various microscopic models, but one of them in particular is interesting, that's ON classical spin model. And what you do there is the following. So you look at the partition function that is simply given to you as a product, or rather, the Gibbs weight of a particular distribution of spins is given by the product of 1 plus x si dot sj, and that's over all nearest neighbors of spins, and then you have to sum it over all spin configurations. Now notice there is no exponent here, and in fact you can either think of this as the high temperature expansion of some exponent, or just take this model for its face value as I have written it. So what you do is when you perform this multiplication and then average over all spin directions, and these are classical spins as I said, it turns out that the only non-vanishing configurations that you get can be graphically represented as loops, and the loops come in n colors which correspond to the number of components of your spin. And well, basically this partition function can be actually written as, in the language that I already used, as sum over alpha over all loop pictures, and then what we get here is x over m to the perimeter of all loops, to the number of all bonds occupied by the loops, times n to the number of loops. And let me quickly sketch the phase diagram for this model. For example, in the honeycomb lattice, this model has been solved by Blerty and, by Nienhaus, and then some extensive numerical work was done by Blerty and Nienhaus, and I'm just going to sketch the phase diagram of that. So this is N over X, which is, we can think of this parameter as the loop tension because it tells me how beneficial, disadvantageous it is to have extra perimeter of my loops. And this is just the N from the ON, which is the number of degrees of freedom of my spin to the number of loops. So this is the phase diagram. Important thing that this is two. The important fact that comes here, well, some numbers are important, some aren't. The important numbers are one on this axis. And this one is important because that's when there is no tension to my loops whatsoever. And you see that the
bare tension.
There is no line tension. What did I say?
No, I just said it's a bare tension, right? There could be an effective.
Well, all right. So there are entropic effects. You're right, but there is no line tension. Should I say at least energetic line tension, bare tension, if you wish to call it? So you see that if this parameter is set to one, then I can readily compare these two expressions, because n is then related to d squared along this line. Now there are two other important numbers, that is one that is here and two, and the reason for that is that this hatched region is the region of the phase diagram where the loops are long. So this is the critical region. Everywhere outside of this region the loops are short, and they're short for different reasons, but yet there is no phase transition as far as I know between them. Here the loops are short simply because there is too much loop tension. Here they are short for purely entropic reasons. That is, when n becomes large, what you want to do is you want to have as many loops as possible, but then you run into the lattice constraints. So if you want to pack as many loops as possible, you should rather make them short. Now, notice something. So the two values of d that I gave you before, one was d equals 1 for the Z2 models beaten to death. It lives right here inside the critical region. And the next value of d for which we can implement a projector was square root of 2, which would correspond to n being equal to 2, which would live right here. Everything else, every other value of d would push my model into the region where the loops are short. But let us concentrate on these two values for the rest of this talk. And of course, in particular, we're interested in this value because that's the first value for which the excitations, which are the ends of the broken loop, are non-abelian, but we should think of both of them, at least for the purpose of this talk. All right, so the important lesson that I've learned so far is that within this region, as well as on its boundary, the model is actually critical. That is, not really. I mean, for example, at this point it's double Gaussian. This is the line along which the critical exponents change. So this point, which I mislabeled here, is the critical point of the easing model, I think.
In terms of Lorentz spins versus
hatched. Yes. So I mean the I'm sorry?
In terms of Lorentz spins versus high temperature disordered fields versus
hatched. Exactly. Well, but it's a little bit strange if you want to talk about spins. For example, this point either corresponds to the high temperature expansion of easing model taken down to zero temperature, or it corresponds to the low temperature expansion, which is just the domain walls taken to the infinite temperature. That's when the domain walls have no tension. So
the dot
the dotted line is the tricritical.
Well, yeah. So in fact, one is right here. One is on this dotted line. So along this line, the solution is known. And if you want to look at the flow, so the flow, I believe,
is from the dotted line to the other line. It's the tricritical line, I think. The dotted line is the trigonal, I think, my
thing is goes like this.
Sure.
So if you want to look at the flow.
One of X is T, right? So load.
Yeah, one of X is T, basically.
So if we look at the polymer case, this is the theta line, the dotted line, so it's the between the compact and the dilute phase. Anyway, we can talk about this.
This is the infinite temperature Ising model. If you want to talk about the domain walls, and it's definitely a stable fixed point. But I think that's the I can pull out all these notes. So let me go back to this and try to use this information to draw some conclusions about the spectrum of a Hamiltonian. So basically what I'm going to do before I start doing it is I'm going to construct the twisted state, twisted in a sense of sort of Lipschultz-Matisse, if you wish, construction. What they've done is they've shown that the antiferromagnetic spin half chain is gapless by explicitly constructing a state, so-called twisted state, which abates certain conditions, and that is what you want. You want that state to be orthogonal to your ground state, and you want to be able to show that the Hamiltonian acting on that state has vanishing energy in the thermodynamic limit. So what I'm going to do is literally equivalent to that. Well, of course, the actual construction is different, but the moral is basically the same. So let me actually do that. Before I do that, let me define two states, which I'm going to call X and Y. And these states look very much like my ground state, this one. Except, so far I'll copy everything from here, except for what goes underneath this sign. Now, what's important is that what goes here. Now, here I sum over all pictures, remember I called my pictures alpha, such that the norm of alpha, which I'm going to define in a second, is less than some parameter lambda times L. And this is going to be greater than lambda. Now, what I mean by this norm is the following. It's some way of measuring the size of the biggest loop in the lattice. So, here is my sample. Let's call it L by L lattice. And I have some collection of loops. So this is the snapshot. This is my alpha. So what I do is I eyeball this picture, and I find the biggest loop in this. And I introduce some way of measuring it, being it a diameter or the size of the smallest square that can fit the biggest loop completely inside. It's some kind of linear dimension of the biggest loop in the lattice. And so what you see is I broke all configurations into two kinds. The ones where the biggest loop is smaller than some cutoff value, and the ones where there is a loop that is bigger than that. Now, here is, there are a couple of observations. Well, first of all, clearly, X plus Y is the ground state, since the ground state contains all these pictures without discriminating between big and large, small and large loops. Second of all, what I want to do is I want to, you know what, I have missed something, but since I don't really have a mic, that will go unrecorded. And what I have missed is normalizing my ground state by this very factor. And I'm going to keep the same normalization here. Now, so this is a trivial fact. Now, what is slightly not trivial is how I will choose my parameter lambda, which I still haven't defined to you. Well, that's simple. What I will want is I will want the norm of the state x to be the same as the norm of state y to be 1/2. So that is, I'm going to choose lambda in such a way that exactly half of my configurations, well, weighted appropriately, fall into one bin and half fall into the other bin. Now, the important observation now is that if my loop model is critical, that is, the loops are scale invariant, then I can actually choose this lambda independently on the size of the box L. And that's important. It clearly would not be true here. But once I'm in the critical regime, I can choose lambda once and for all so that I don't need to worry about the size of my lattice. Then I can take the size of the lattice to infinity without ever readjusting the parameter lambda. All right, so that was actually an important observation. Now let me go ahead and construct the, in the remaining 10 minutes, construct the twisted state as advertised. So psi 1 is going to be nothing but the difference between these states, and that is x minus y. In fact, a slightly more intelligent construction would involve breaking all my collection of loops, or collection of states, not into two, but into many more bins and twisting them sort of gently with the phases. But this is sort of the most violent, the simplest and the most violent way of twisting the state I can imagine, but even that will do. So let me proceed with that.
The Lieb-Mathis-Schultz argument, what you do is you impose a same bonds or something, so you twist the boundary condition.
Well, it's not exactly the same, so I don't really twist the boundary conditions in that sense. I don't twist the spins on the other side, but I do construct a state which is twisted in the following sense, that some configurations come with a plus sign, some configurations come with a minus sign. And in principle, you know, as I said, I could make it a slightly more subtle by assigning phases to them, but I'll just go with that.
The twist doesn't occur in real space, it occurs in configuration space, which is not really local.
Right, and there is interpretation of producing a solid or something like that with arbitrary low energy. Here, I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah, first of all, as Chaitin said, it's the twist in the configuration state, so I don't even know what it's meaning in terms of the local variable. So.
But it still has low energy, that's the point. Yeah. Well, that's what he's going to show.
So yeah, from that point of view, it's not exactly like Lipschitz-Mathis construction. All right. So the reason why I mentioned sort of a probably more subtle way of twisting it is that if you do it in a way that I'm not going to pursue, you can actually show that the spectrum of the excitations goes as k squared, which should be dear to your heart, because that's the kind of that's the kind of stuff the kind of behavior we expect in these quantum Lipschitz points. This construction just allows me to show that it's gapless with z equals 1. But as I said, it's a weaker version of the argument, but it's a much simpler version of the argument. All right, so let me just proceed with that. So I noticed something. I noticed that, first of all, psi 1 is 1 because of the normalization I had before. And also, psi 0 is 0. So this state is orthogonal to the ground state. Now,
and that's true asymptotically for large system size or for any system size.
Well, I mean, provided I can choose lambda. So if you really talk about small systems, you know, if you have five states, then how exactly do you make it exactly happen?
So if I pick an arbitrary lambda, then this is supposed to be viewed as being true in infinite systems.
Yeah, but I mean the point is that you don't really need to go to the infinite system for that to be true to the sort of with exponential precision.
It's not an arbitrary lambda. Lambda is chosen to make this true in essence, right? Lambda is chosen to make xx and yy a norm a half.
No, but I mean the question is if your Hilbert space consists of five states only.
No, I understand. But I'm just saying it's not an arbitrary lambda.
So for every system size, I have to choose a particular lambda. I thought you said in a critical system, I have.
Yeah, that's right. As you go to infinite system size, it has some adjust to some value,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
A particular value, though.
Okay. Right, yeah. Okay.
Independent of system size.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So. Let's just do what we need to do now, and that is find out what the expectation value of the Hamiltonian in this twisted state is. And that, of course, I need to subtract V. Is it too low? I can actually go up there. So what I need to do is I need to calculate this quantity. And feeding the definitions of psi 1 and psi naught, this is psi 1 and this is psi naught once again, or rather this, I can easily relate that. So, you know, this is my energy gap, delta E. So what I can show is that this is nothing but 4x. And the reason why that happens is that you see that xx that will be present here and here will cancel, so it will happen with yy. And the only terms that don't cancel are the ones that connect the two. All right, but now we observe something rather important. And that is, let's ask ourselves, what are the states that are connected by the Hamiltonian? And I already erased the Hamiltonian, one of the Hamiltonians that I was talking about. But the important thing is that the Hamiltonian is local, and all it can do, it can bend the loops, or it can create small loops. But now remember, what is my definition of X? That's the collection of states that only have loops no longer than certain cutoff limit. And Y are the states that have loops longer than this cutoff limit. So essentially, the only states that can contribute here are the states where the longest loop is just below the cutoff, and here it's just above the cutoff. The important point is that the Hamiltonian is only allowed to change the size of the loop by at most its range, and I did assume that the Hamiltonian was local. So whatever the range of the Hamiltonian is, whether it's 10 lattice size, it's fine with me. But if that's the range of the Hamiltonian, then the largest increase in the loops diameter can be 10 lattice sites top. So what this means is that if I look at the distribution of my states in some sense, so you know, let's the probability of having this size alpha. This is alpha. I assume it's some kind of monotonic nice function. And here is my cutoff limit, which I choose once and for all. And the only states that contribute are the ones that are inside this thin sliver around my cutoff. So these are the states x, and these are the states y. Now, I do assume the scale invariant nature of my loops. That is, this is the distribution function that is independent on the size of my system. On the other hand, the size of this sliver shrinks with the with increasing the size of the system, because it's, I mean, essentially it's the whatever the range of Hamiltonian divided by the size of the system. Does that make sense? Well, so what I immediately observe is that this quantity vanishes in thermodynamic limits simply by then counting the number of states. So that's all the infinity. Now, notice something. Notice that it was essential for this proof that I did not have projectors implemented in my Hamiltonian. Because having a projector makes this proof invalid, because having a projector in principle allows me to have two state, or to have a state where the size of each loop is, let's say, about a half of my cutoff. And then implementing a projector here, I could have immediately doubled the size. So the fact that the state was gapless is, in some sense, an artifact of very slow dynamics of the Hamiltonian, which doesn't have projectors implemented. Now, what's interesting, though, is that the two Hamiltonians, as I said, with and without projectors, have the same ground state, with the same correlations in the ground state. So that's just an interesting example that the equal time correlation, that is the correlations in the ground state, need not tell you anything intelligent about the spectrum of your Hamiltonian. So here's an explicit example of two Hamiltonians with and without projector turned on. One of them is gapless, the other one, at least for d equals 1, we know the examples where it's explicitly gapful, provably gapful. So I think I'm out of time, and
you could take 10 minutes or 5 minutes to wrap up or whatever.
Right. So one thing, I mean, I could do two things. I could tell you a little bit, sort of go back and tell you about the relations between projectors and statistics, if anybody finds that interesting, how to obtain the statistics of excitations, you know, having these rules on loops, or I can mention something about the field theory, but that would be very, very sketchy. So, or I can finish right now. So, any.
Normally the speakers choose.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, so these may be topics for experts. So you want to.
All right. So let me.
You want to just do discussions with the experts on those topics you just listed privately.
Sure. Or I can do a 5-minute. You know, show how to get statistics out of implementing projectors, if that's...
That would be nice, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anybody? Well, first of all, let me just mention, I keep saying that you need projectors. By now, you don't even need anything else to realize that, since I've shown you that without projectors, the theory is gapless, somehow the notion of statistics goes out of the window, because, I mean, when we talk about statistics, what we really want to do is to know what happens to the wave function when you do adiabatic transport of quasi-particles around each other, and the moment your Hamiltonian is gapless, the whole issue of adiabaticity is out of the window. But let me sort of give you an explicit construction of statistics with projectors present, and I will do it for the simple case, but probably not the case that you know by heart, or some of you know by heart. So the simplest case that we all have seen before is the case of Z2 topological kind of theories that have a projector that does this. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to look at the case D equals minus 1, which is very, very similar to that, but gives a slightly non-trivial statistic to its excitation. So what do I mean by D being minus 1? What that means is that now every time I add an extra loop to my collection of loops, I get the extra amplitude, which is minus 1, and it also means that this operation now happens with the minus sign. So let's now talk about the the statistics of the excitations in this kind of picture. So I told you what excitations are. The excitations are the endpoints of loops. And so this is sort of a generic excitation. I paid the energy to break a loop, and now I have two ends, and one end is somewhere out there, and the other end is here. If I, you know, I'm not doing a particularly careful job here, but the important thing is that what I want to do is I want to actually construct an excitation, which I will put a circle here, which is an eigenstate of twist. So basically what this means is that I want my excitation to be, so here is the condition that implements what I just said. That a picture like this, where I simply sort of twisted this particle by 2 pi, is e to the 2 pi I s times this. Now, the reason why I do this is that in principle, there is no rule that tells me that a bare excitation that looks like this is actually equivalent to that. It's not in my Hamiltonian. What my Hamiltonian allows me to do is take two strands, cut and reconnect them. Please do that and you'll find out that this picture is related to this picture by doing this projection. But it will not relate these two pictures. So in principle, I should treat these two as independent kind of pictures. So, and I'm going to do that. So that means I'm going to represent this as a linear combination of this picture and that picture.
Without the circle in the last one?
Sorry, without the circle, yes. These are the bare ends of loops. And the dressed one is going to be a linear combination of these. And so what I need to do now is I just need to take this and fit it in here. So,
do you want to explain why you don't have two twists in that linear?
Yeah. So I just showed that the twist in this direction and the twist in the other direction are not independent. But if you take two twists, and in fact that's what I was going to do in a second anyway. So you can imagine having two twists. What you see is that you can apply the projector to the two lines here. Having done that, you get a minus one and reconnect them like this. And now what you can see is that there is this sort of, if you wish, tongue that you can sort of shrink and make this picture just being minus that. So the only two pictures that are independent under this dynamics of my Hamiltonian are this picture and that picture. So let's just do it really quickly. So now what I want to do is I want to apply this to that. And so this, I need to check me, is nothing but, well, basically I just feed this. So it's alpha times that plus beta times the double twist. And I already told you what the double twist is. So it's just, well, it's beta times the double twist. But the double twist, as I've just shown, is nothing but minus untwisted picture. And so what you do is you relate the two. Well, and of course, I expand this picture as e to the 2 pi I s, this alpha this plus beta this. And now since I consider these independent, I just make sure that the coefficients in front of the terms match, and what you get is two simple equations, and the equations are just that alpha is equal to e to the I 2 pi s beta, and the other one is negative beta, it's this one, negative beta, equal to e to the I 2 pi s alpha. From where you immediately find out that e to the 4 pi is equal to minus 1. So the value of topological spin from here is either plus or minus a quarter. And you immediately find the relation between, well, depending on which of these numbers you pick, you find the relations between these alpha and beta. So now let's convert that into statistics. So that's even simpler, because what's statistics? So now I have two excitations. Each of them now is this dressed excitation, the eigenstate of a topological spin. Let's say I choose 1/4 here. If I choose 1/4, that automatically means that alpha is equal to I times beta by feeding it back here. And let's just make them, you know, alpha to be 1 and beta to be, alpha is I and beta is 1, for example. All right, so, but what statistics is it's the, what happens to this picture once I decide to exchange the excitations. And pay attention to the fact that I've done it in such a way that I did not twist the line around the particle. By the way, for those of you, let me sort of give you a hint for why twisting a line around a particle is a bad idea. This is kind of clear if you know a little bit about Chern-Simons theories, because Chern-Simons theory, the excitation carries both charge and a flux, and when you do a twist around itself, there is sort of an internal Aronoff bomb phase that you pick from taking a flux around the charge, so you have to be careful about things like this. What?
That's a Rayleigh number.
Yeah.
It's not Rayleigh.
All right, so now having done that, I can once again use my knowledge of projectors to operate on these two lines. And if I do that, I realize that this is nothing but minus 1 times this picture. But this picture, I know what to do with. I know how to untwist it. So this is minus 1 times whatever the value e to the 2 pi is of the untwisted picture. Now this is either I or minus I, depending on which value of spin I picked. And you see that the exchange of two particles leads to the multiplication of my wave function by either I or minus I in this particular case, which means that these particles are either semions or antisemions. Now, if you do the same with this three-strand projector, which I did not do here, what you'll end up realizing is that if you start with a combination, and here I should be careful drawing all four endpoints of my loops. If you play the same exact game, you end up with this picture ending in superposition. So you exchange the two particles, and you end up in the pictures that look like this and that. And these are the linear independent, the two linear independent states, which once again is something that is familiar to people who were playing with Majorana modes and you know the Fatian theories. When you have four quasi-particles, you have two degenerate ground states, and that's precisely the two ground states that you get. And by sort of doing the explicit twist plus applying the projector, you can explicitly derive statistics in terms of the pictures.
That's when you choose.
That's when you choose the
root two.
Yeah, the root two. So that's the first non-abelian case. So it requires a little bit more care when you do these kind of calculations and twist them around. So that's why I didn't show it here. Just a little bit messier, but other than that, it's exactly the same kind of calculation that you have to go through. So, and as you see that having the projector is really essential for getting the statistics right. So I was using it all the time. So without them, I wouldn't even know how to relate these pictures.
Now, The wave functions you were constructing were more topological, they were critical, right?
Well, without projectors, yes.
Without projectors.
The same wave function, though.
Yeah, well, unless you're on the torus.
So now once you include the projector, they are no longer critical. They are
at least in D equals 1 case, yes.
D equals 1. So what happens for root 2?
Yeah, so for root 2, it's kind of tricky because.
So root 2, the critical case corresponds to the fully factored model, is that what you have in mind? Or is the
no, it can be anywhere on this line. So this is a fully packed
right.
limit.
So it's anywhere on the line.
But it's anywhere on the line. In fact, there are two points that are interesting, as you mentioned. One is the fully packed,
yeah.
and the other one is here at 1. But if you do some modifications to a Hamiltonian, then in principle, it can end up anywhere on this line.
OK, so projection, the condition of projection here is some kind of like a gluing condition in some sense, like pairing, it's like some sort of pairing condition that you
want. What do you mean by the pairing condition?
Well, you claim that the theory presumably is topological.
Well, all right, so here is the part that I don't fully understand, to be honest with you. But the statement is that, well, in order for the projector to operate, I mean, the projector is some kind of local operator that acts on, I don't know how many lattice plaquettes, but it's a finite number of them. So you need to have the situation when three different lines come within the range of your Hamiltonian that can cut and reconnect them. And it's really easy to do for two lines, because inside the critical region, typically two lines come together infinite number of times. They come together in the counter set of points. But three lines, and there is an argument which I'm not 100% certain about, but sort of 99% certain about, the argument that tells you that statistically this never happens. Which is bad news, because it tells you that even if you write down that term in the Hamiltonian, it really doesn't do anything to alleviate this condition here. So the proof of gaplessness will go through even in the presence of the projector, simply because Even though it's technically there, it just doesn't do anything to help you reconnect the loops. And I don't quite understand that. I mean, why sort of statistical mechanics gets in the way of if you wish, algebra.
But if I understand correctly, that's a question of whether you can sort of get this projector from doing something to a Hamiltonian, is that right? I mean, you could just implement the projector on
Yeah, sure.
Whatever.
But I mean, the point is that, I mean, I can still do the same conclusion I've done
okay.
before. And my question is, I mean, does this quantity do something, that...
Sure, okay.
Yeah. Is it a non-vanishing quantity? And I'm not certain it is. That's why I think your construction is a much better construction. Trivalent graphs, because there you are within the critical region, so and provided you can implement the projector in a nice way, which in terms of your graph is actually a two-line projector, because every line is a doubled line sort of secretly. So that's why you actually stand the chance of getting into topological phase there.
Any other questions?
So going back to your proof in this low energy, individual of low energy excitation, I guess you can extend the similar argument to 3 division, 4 division, x, y, z.
Yeah, that's what I said. So if I actually did this carefully, I would show that this goes as 1 over L. Well, in fact, it goes as the range of the Hamiltonian, whatever you want to call it, over L. But if I made k divisions, so something like this, and take k to infinity, separate that from L to infinity, I could show that it actually goes as that squared. So in fact, this is a critical theory that z equals 2, not z equals 1.
You can actually prove there are many low energy states, not just 2.
Yeah, so. And moreover, this is something you really want to see z equals 2, because you know we know that this is kind of characteristic of these quasi-topological theories that arise around Dimer models and you know critical six vertex, you know, like model like Dorn and Paul studying. It's, you know, z equals 2 is kind of ubiquitous there.
Is there some few theoretic or continuum limit picture which goes with this? And what do these projectors then mean? Is it indeed some kind of wavelength? Wow.
It's a question.
Well, the projectors make sense in Chern-Simons theories. I'm sorry?
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as the field theoretic picture without these projectors, we have conjectured in field theory. That doesn't look anything particularly pretty, and I can show you what it is in private, which is nothing but a non-abelian generalization of a much simpler field theory that, well, these guys were studying, once again, which is something like pi squared plus whatever it's...
grad pi squared.
Yeah, it's
grad pi squared. Grad pi.
Sorry. No, no.
No, no.
No, no. It's pi squared, and then it's
Laplacian.
Yeah, it's the Laplacian of pi squared. That's right. And that's once again the z equals 2 theory. Because yeah, so this theory doesn't. Well, this is abelian. What I said is that you know we conjectured a non-abelian version of that, which. Any other questions?
You recognize that your construction there, of course, is just S2 level 1. V equals minus 1.
Yeah.
It's like the Laplace bosonic state. You get the semi-sensitive.
Well, I mean, it's easy to write down the. I mean, sure, it's U1 cross U1 Chern-Simons theory. So.
Right.
So or S U2 level 1, if you right. wish.
Well, because you are at U2 level.
Yeah. Well, that's why I mentioned sort of charges and fluxes, because right. here you get them explicitly. Right. So you know that that's exactly what you deserve for the twisting.
Okay. There's no other questions. Let's back to Rob.